go ahead and be opening your Bibles to Luke chapter 16, please. Luke chapter 16. Goes without saying that there are many things in the Bible that are simple to understand, and there are many things in the Bible that are challenging to understand. Sometimes we read various passages we come across and we wonder, what does that mean? Why is that in there? And I want to this evening, for a few moments, look at a few verses from Luke chapter 16 that's always been somewhat baffling to me. We're going to study this evening about the parable of the unjust steward. I don't know about you, but I frequently read through this, and it wasn't really until I sat down and studied this that I really understood the point of this parable. Why did Jesus, as he talks about this man, this steward, that's been irresponsible with his master's goods and who's being essentially fired from his position, why does the master respond by commending this steward for his shrewdness? Because he'd done something unjust, because he'd been unfair, because he'd essentially stolen from his master, yet he is commended. And then it's said that the sons of light, which we as Christians identify with those sons of light, we need to be like that unjust steward. Just never really understood what that parable was, and it wasn't until studying that passage that I really came to a greater understanding. So this evening I'd like to take a little bit of our time to unravel that parable of the unjust steward. Now, we're going to read through that in its entirety here in just a moment, verses 1 through 12. But let's just start by kind of identifying the various people that we read about. Let's just go ahead and read through that. Luke chapter 16, we'll begin our reading in verse 1, please. He also said to his disciples, "There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward.' Then the steward said within himself, 'What shall I do? For my master is taking away the stewardship from me. I cannot dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I have resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses.' So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, 'How much do you owe?' So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill, write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is faithful in what is least is also faithful in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is also unjust in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own?" So as we read through this parable, we identify essentially three characters, two very prominent ones, one being the rich man. As we read about him and as Jesus is telling this parable, remember, this is not an actual account. It's a parable. It's a story. It's something that the people, Jesus' audience, the listeners during that day would be able to relate to. And based off of this example, this analogy essentially, they would be able to make spiritual application based off of the things that Jesus said. But in this parable, we see identified at the very beginning this rich man. He was a landowner. Likely the land was held for investments. It was used to produce oil and wheat. And we would identify this with God. Secondly, we have the unjust steward. They are the sons of this world, those who aren't Christians, those who live in this world and who seek all that this world has to offer, who seek to increase in the gains of this world. This term steward is not a term that we talk about very much, but it's a role that we are familiar with. Simply put, the steward was a manager for his master. That is, he had control of his master's business affairs and probably his assets as well. And so likely he would have been paid based off of how well he managed his master's possessions. And we see this particular steward is in control of at least this piece of ground, maybe more. Think back to the book of Exodus if you have trouble grasping that idea of what a steward did. You remember Joseph, whenever he's in Egypt for Pharaoh, and as he serves under Pharaoh, remember it's how it's said that all Pharaoh had to worry about was simply what he ate and what he drank. and his wife, and those were the only cares that he had, because Joseph oversaw all of the affairs of the land of Egypt. He was essentially a steward on behalf of Pharaoh, who was king, who was ruler in Egypt. And this steward in this parable particularly identifies with the sons of this world. And then we've got one other minor character. We've got here the master's debtors, who perhaps these men who leased the land to farm upon. And upon harvest, then they would in turn pay the master part of what they had made, part of the produce of the land, whether it be the oil or whether it be the wheat. They would in turn give part of that to the master for use of his land. And so let's just kind of work our way through this text in Luke chapter 16. We see in verse 1 that an accusation is brought against this steward, that he's wasting his master's goods. We're not told specifically who the accuser was, and for the sake of the parable, it really doesn't matter. Maybe it was an enemy or a servant that disliked the steward that brought this to the master's attention. Maybe it was a tenant who wasn't happy with the property and as it was being managed. And so he goes and he tells the master that the steward's being unwise with his possessions. Or maybe it was a friend that was really concerned about the master, and as he saw his friend being taken advantage of, he says, well, he needs to know about that. For whatever reason, this accuser brings to this master's attention that his deed and his goods and his land is being used frivolously. And you know, this was a particularly grievous crime. You go back to Luke chapter 15, where Jesus tells that great parable of the prodigal son. You know, that phraseology that the prodigal son wasted his master, his father's belongings with riotous living. And you see the anger, and you understand the anger that the Jews would have had when they heard about what that young man had done with his father's possessions, wasting someone else's goods, wasting someone else's possessions. And you can understand a little bit this accusation and the seriousness of what the steward had done by being frivolous with his master's possession. And then we see this betrayal of trust. And if anybody here invests, you perhaps can appreciate in a unique way what this master experienced. Suppose that you put your money, part of your paycheck that you work hard for and you spend your time toiling for, you put that in the hand of this financial investor, and they in turn use that money that you've given them to make wise investment decisions so that your money might grow and it might multiply. Well, come to find out, suppose that someone you give your hard-earned money to invest in, you find out they were wasting it. They were skimming some off the top. They weren't doing you due diligence despite the fact that you're giving them and trusting them with your money. You see, you feel that betrayal of trust. If that happened in real life, then I think we would quickly remove whoever it was from that position. And that's what we see with this steward. His master finds out he's being frivolous with his money, with his possessions. And so he says, you're no longer going to be steward. You're going to have to give an account for all of your misdeeds. And the steward in verse 3, we see somewhat of an interesting reaction. Whenever someone's caught doing wrong, I don't know about you, but the few times I've done wrong in my life and been caught, no. The times that I have done wrong in my life, and I knew that I was doing wrong, whenever it's brought to your attention and whenever it's made public, you feel shame. You feel embarrassed. You feel bad, and sometimes, perhaps maybe for the right reason, your eyes are open to what you've done. But at the very least, you put on a show of repentance. Hopefully you don't do this if you're caught wrong, but you put on a show of repentance because you're embarrassed and you're ashamed of being caught in whatever action it was or whatever sin it was. But the steward shows absolutely no remorse. There's no repentance when you go and you look at him. He's only concerned about, okay, I'm about to be thrown out. I'm going to lose my stewardship. Only more scheming is really what this man is interested in. He's lost his master's trust. Of course he's not going to receive a good recommendation as a steward. My options, what are they? They're digging and they're begging. Digging would be reserved for perhaps the lowest skill, lowest of intelligence in society. Just basic manual labor, working on the end of a shovel. He said, I'm not able to dig. He'd been a steward all of his life. He lived a privileged life, wealthy. He wouldn't have had to engage in hard labor. He'd be like that manager, perhaps, at a corporation. He'd be using his mind and working hard with that, perhaps, but his back wouldn't be used to hard manual labor. He said, I can't dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. Those who were unable to work, they begged. And the steward was too proud for that. He would have been in this respectable position as a steward of his master's house, but now the only options left to him were begging and digging, and he didn't like either of those. So verse 4, as you're reading there, he comes to himself. He said within himself, I know what I'm going to do. I know how I'm going to respond to this situation. I've got a plan. And so he comes up with this plan since he's about to be thrown out and lose the stewardship, where he's going to be placed in good standing with other well-to-do men who, after he is removed from his stewardship, will then be able to perhaps be in need of a steward of their own. And oh, maybe they'll remember that I scratched their back back in the day. They'll offer to me the same sort of kindness, the same sort of generosity. In some translations, if you look at your little heading over, I'm using New King James, and it refers to this man as the unjust steward. You may be using a different one, and you may see that he's referred to as the shrewd steward. That's how Jesus refers to him later on in the parable. He refers to his shrewdness. We really see that evidenced here in these next few verses, verses 4 through 7 of this parable. We see that he earns this reputation, this title given by Jesus for good reason. Now, it's not real clear from the English language, but what we find out when you go back to the original, that what the steward did, he called his master's debtors in individually. He didn't just call some big meeting, anyone that owed his masters, and say, come on. He called them individually. He wants to speak to them on their own. He's got this idea where he can position himself well with his master's debtors, but he doesn't need any of the rest of them to know about it. He needs to talk to them individually. And so he calls them all, these men who would have taken on large debts, men who would be able to hire a steward of their own, perhaps whenever he's looking for a position. Maybe farmers of the master's lands that when they harvested their crops, they would pay to the master that predetermined amount. Also, you understand why the steward did this. Ancients of this point in time would have viewed an obligation or a generous gift such as a steward's going to do with his master's resources. They would have viewed that in view of reciprocity. They would be very obligated to respond as a steward had done for them. He had scratched their back. They would feel obligated, almost a sense of duty, to respond and show him some sort of kindness. And so he pretends that he's still his master steward, that he possesses this authority to make financial decisions on behalf of his master's goods. And so he calls these men, and he essentially reduces their debts, you might say. Reading through this, and once again, this was just based from the fact that I never really dug into this parable to find out what's taking place. I always thought that the steward forgave some of the debts of his master, that he called these men in, and that he essentially forgave a portion of that, but as you read through it, it becomes pretty obvious that he didn't earn the name Shrewd Steward because he forgave his master's debts. What he was doing was he was lying about the amount of resources, oil and wheat, the two examples Jesus uses, that his master's debtors owed him. So he was saying, how much do you owe? One man came in and he said, well, I owe 100 measures of oil. Well, he said, sit down, write 50. The steward would have been the one who determined the amount of money. The master's debtors were to give it to him. And so he says, let's change this. Sit down and you write, you don't owe 100. You only actually owe 50 measures of oil. Oil would have been used for many things. Olive oil would have come from olive trees. And it would have been used for many things. Lamp oil, treating wounds, preparation for food. Approximately 850 gallons of oil, which would be the yield of about 150 olive trees. That's a lot of olive oil. And so essentially what he does is he doesn't forgive. He changes the debt of this man who owes us 100 measures of oil, essentially erasing about 500 denarii. Now you remember, one denarii is one day's wages. So he's forgiving essentially 500 days' wages. This other man comes in and he owes his master a predetermined amount of wheat. He says, how much do you owe? He says, I owe 100 measures of wheat. So he says, sit down, change your bill, so that you also owe 80 measures of wheat. We understand the value that that would have had during that day and time. Once again, he's forgiving about 500 days' wages, 500 denarii, from both the debtor who owed oil and the debtor who owed wheat. And so by changing what was owed by his master's debtors, he's accomplished here two things. One, that's quite obvious, he's earned the gratitude of his master's debtors. He's given them essentially 500 days' wages to be removed from their debt. And so, by doing that, what he's now done is he has indebted his master's debtors to him, so that when he's thrown out, maybe one of them will look on him with a little bit of kindness and remember, oh, he helped me out back in the day. Maybe I can find some work for him to do for me. That's one of the things he did. But secondly, if these men didn't respond, if these master's debtors, whenever he's thrown out and he's needing help, if they don't respond in the way that he wants, you know what? He can blackmail them. Did you read the language of how he went about this scheme? He said, you sit down. You write out how much you owe. He has this information that they lied, that they were dishonest. They would have signed their name to it. They would have made their mark so that it would have been recognizable by the master with his debtors. And so he doesn't sit down and change it out himself. He says, no, you change it. You cut your debt in half. You say that you only owe 50. And what he's done, we don't know the end of the story. We don't know if he's required to blackmail one of his master's debtors so that he might be welcomed into their home. But if he needed to, then that's also a position that he would be in. You see his shrewdness. I mean, we don't know if he took advantage of the situation, but you see his shrewdness as he sat down and worked through this situation. And then we come to the part of the parable that's always been challenging to understand. Verse 8. The master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. When the master finds out what the steward is doing, you might expect a lot of reactions. If you think that was you and you put yourself in the position of the master and you find out someone's been squandering your money, the equivalent of perhaps $95,000 worth of your money, 500 denarii, that's just a rough estimation perhaps. You place yourself in that position. Somebody's wasting almost $100,000 of your money. You fire them for sure. You press charges, probably. You have them thrown in jail. You make sure that what was yours was brought back. Maybe you just find somebody to take it out of his hide, don't you? You don't brag about his shrewdness and his wisdom because he was able to steal from you right under your nose. But yet, verse 8, that's exactly what the master did. He commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. Well, this could be taken and misapplied in a lot of ways. We need to make sure that we don't do it. Let's understand what's not happening. There's some who might look at this parable and might attempt to justify wrong done by the steward within the context of work. And so what they might say is, well, whenever I'm at work and I'm in a situation like the steward, because we see the master commending him, we see that positive response to what is obviously wrong that's been done. And so they might say, well, if I'm at work, that removes me from my obligation to follow the commands of God. And you know, if I've got to be dishonest, if I've got to lie, and if I've got to cheat, and if I've got to forge some numbers or forge some signatures to work my way up the ladder, that's perfectly okay because the master commended the unjust steward. If you look at that and that's what you read, then you're reading this from the wrong perspective. There is no excuse for that sort of wickedness. In fact, the language that's used to describe the wrong that the steward has done, just in case there's any confusion because someone might want to misinterpret it, this language is applied to the steward. The fact that he is being unjust, the language from that is the same word that's used back in Luke chapter 13 where Jesus says, "Depart from me, you workers of iniquity." That's the same word used that's applied to the unjust steward. And in Acts chapter 8 and verse 23, when Peter is speaking to Simon the sorcerer, he says, "You're poisoned with bitterness. You're bound by iniquity." That's that same Greek word that's used here to describe the steward's actions. So let someone look at this and say, well, this is an example for me at work to be able to be dishonest, like the steward would be dishonest, and be commended for that because we're supposed to be like him. Don't misunderstand what this parable is saying. He is never commended for being evil. What he's commended for is his forethought, for his ability to think ahead. And in a worldly sense, if you pull out the morality of this story, then he acted in a way that was very wise, in a way that would secure for him a comfortable future for his physical well-being. That was thinking ahead, was it not? And we see why Jesus told this parable in verse 8. The master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. And here's Jesus' point. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. The sons of this world, those people that are worldly, those people that will, by whatever means necessary, do whatever it takes to put themselves at a disadvantage, or at an advantage over others, whether it be financially or whether it be at work or at home or in a relationship, they'll do whatever it takes. So act with all sort of human wisdom and shrewdness and scheming, just as this man did here, so that they might come up on top. The sons of this world, we're told, behave in such a manner. But the sons of light, those who are children of God, don't take the same measure to secure their spiritual well-being. And that's the point. Those in this world will do whatever it takes to secure for themselves physical, comfortable future. Now the question is, why do sons of this world not behave with the same amount of forethought? Why do the sons of light, God's children, not apply the same forethought that the sons of this world do? Why do they not use the same shrewdness to think ahead so that they might secure for themselves a future, not physically, spiritually? That's the application that Jesus is trying to make here in this parable. That's the lesson that Jesus is teaching. Not that you use your possessions to make friends of this world, but that you secure for yourself your spiritual well-being. Well, Christians, we'll work 30 years, pay on a house for 30 years so that we might own that house and we might secure for us a place, a home, in which we might retire and live comfortably. People who will save every penny that they can so that whenever they get to that point in time in their life where they want to retire, that they're able to do so comfortably and they don't have to worry about money coming in and they don't have to worry about where the next paycheck is going to come from, that they can use that money they've invested and they've saved. We put physically our wisdom and our shrewdness toward that physical secured future, but so oftentimes what's neglected is that spiritual future. You know, this world is temporal. And God's children, too oftentimes, we behave with the shrewdness of the steward toward our physical end, our physical preparation. But we don't have that same wisdom and we don't have that same shrewdness when it comes to securing for ourselves that spiritual future, which is infinitely more important. And that's Jesus' point. And then he makes application in verses 9 through 12. His point is, I would say, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Verse 9 is somewhat challenging to be understood. Make for yourself friends by unrighteous mammon. So it sounds like he's saying, I need to make for myself friends through the use of this world's goods, whether it be money or whether it be the things that God has given me, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Well, how do friends of this world, whom we've helped out, whom we've been kind to, receive us into an everlasting home? Remember, parables are not to be understood in the literal sense. They're analogies that teach us spiritual truths. To be trusted with these true riches, and we're going to have to show ourselves trustworthy with worldly riches. So how do we make friends with unrighteous mammon that welcome us into their heavenly home? And missed that a long time ago. I would say that the answer, the application of that, the way that's fulfilled, it's right here in Matthew chapter 25, verses 37 through 40. Notice here the application. I think you'll see how it ties in to Luke chapter 16 and verse 9 that we just read. The righteous one will answer him saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in? When did we see you naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick and in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, surely I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. These people, Matthew 25, they say, Jesus, when did we feed you? When did we give you drink? When did we give you clothes? When did we visit you when you were sick and when you were in prison? These people used their worldly goods when they did it to the least of those in this world. That, by the unrighteous mammon, money, possessions, things that they were generous with toward those in this world, by doing that, they assured for themselves a spiritual future. And that's what Jesus says there in that parable, Matthew 25. That's why he says to them, enter in, because you had these things and you used them, you shared them, you were generous. That's why you enter into God's kingdom. And then conversely, those that didn't get, that weren't allowed in, they didn't share their things. They weren't generous. They weren't kind. And so you see that the use of worldly, carnal mammon in sharing and generosity, which resulted in these individuals being welcomed into the kingdom of God. And you read Luke 16:9 again. I say to you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon. Share with those that don't have, so that when you fail, they receive you into an everlasting home. Indirectly, their kindness to those who were in need through the things that they had resulted in their being welcomed into God's kingdom when their life was over. That's how that passage ties in. That's what Jesus is talking about there in Luke chapter 16 and verse 9. So let's make a little bit of application and we'll bring our study to a close this evening. Things that we can take away from this parable in Luke chapter 16. We are stewards. We are not masters. Remember, the master was the one who owned the land. The master was the one who was the possessor. The steward had absolutely no right, no control. Yes, he had authority. Yes, he was placed in a responsible position, but the land didn't belong to him. He simply managed what was his master's. A steward owns nothing. He manages what is his master's. And if you think about what you have, physically, these carnal things, the mammon that Jesus talks about, your time, your money, your opportunities, your talents and the abilities that God has given you, your life, everything that we have is from God. These are my things, though. This is my money. I earned it. I went to work. I worked hard. I put in overtime so that I could buy these nice things for myself. Who gave you the strength to go to work? Who let you wake up in the morning with health well enough where you could go and you could work at your job so that you might make that money and buy those things? Who blessed you with that good mind that has allowed you to be successful? Where did the good health that you enjoy come from? We own nothing. God owns everything. He is the creator. We are the creature. Everything belongs to Him. And it's a humbling thought. It may be things that we don't like thinking about, because yes, we do invest our time and our efforts. But we oftentimes forget, as James says, every good and every perfect gift comes from above, from the Father of lights. Every good thing that we enjoy is from God. We aren't masters. We are but stewards with what God has entrusted us. And with some He has entrusted a little. With some He's entrusted a lot. It doesn't really matter. It's not mine. It's God's. It leads me to a second point, that I need to be wise with the things that God has placed in my stewardship, the things with which God has entrusted me. Are you using what God's given you wisely? Your time and your health and your money and your homes and your vehicles and your good minds and your talents and your opportunities? Are you using those things that God has given you wisely? Master called the steward before him in this parable to give an account. He said, come, you're going to have to give an account of your stewardship. You're going to have to give an account and answer for how you've used my goods. And it was obvious he had not used them in a wise way. Christians, we're going to have to stand before God as stewards. And He's going to ask us. We're going to have to give an account to our master for the things that we used, that He gave us while we were on this earth. And in this parable, the steward wisely used his master's possessions to secure for him a future. The way he went about it was underhanded, and it was deceitful, but it did ensure that he'd be taken care of, didn't it? It did ensure that he was going to have a future provided for him. Now, we need to possess that same forethought in regard to securing for ourselves, not a physical future, but a spiritual future. We don't do that by but just squandering what God has given us. We do that by, as we read in Matthew chapter 25, by giving to those who don't have, by being generous with the things which God has placed in our stewardship, by helping others. Sometimes it's hard to give something you have, to take what you've worked for and to give it to someone else. I'll be the first to say it's hard sometimes to do that. That's why Jesus uses this parable to remind us. Not really mine to begin with. It's His. He gave it to me. He entrusted it to me. And if you think about it like that, that whenever I help somebody else, I'm not giving them what's mine. I'm giving them what's God's. You might say what I'm actually doing is I'm giving God's what's God's. Because He gave it to me. And I'm using it to His cause, as He told me that I needed to do. Kind of seems like a sacrifice when you think of it as my stuff. But yet when I realize He gave it to me and I'm just simply using it to His glory, kind of lets the air out of you. But everything's His, and the generosity of heart that God sees and He's pleased with. So ask yourself, are you wisely using what God has placed in your stewardship today? And as we can tell, go Matthew 25 again. It has implications on our eternal destiny. And lastly, you can't serve both God and mammon. That's how Jesus concludes the parable. No man can serve two masters in Luke 16 and verse 13. And He says the same thing in Matthew 6:24. You're either going to love one and hate the other, you're going to cling to one, or you're going to despise the other. Jesus concludes the parable with this statement, and He refers to it as mammon. He refers to it as unrighteousness, because physical, carnal things in contrast to God are in opposition. And if you try to serve both, and that's what so oftentimes the mistake we make. We don't just solely serve mammon. What we try to do is we try to serve both.
We try to serve mammon, and we try to serve God. We try to serve our own desires, and our jobs, and our relationships, and our friendships, and our hobbies, and our entertainments. We try to serve both those and God. And brethren, if we try to do that, then we haven't chosen God. Jesus makes it clear, no man can serve two masters. You can't serve both God and mammon. So if you serve both, you made your decision. You're not serving God. So which master this evening are you serving? Are you serving the master of this world, the master that is yourself? Are you serving your master in heaven? The things in this world, if you serve them, they'll consume you. They'll enslave you. They'll bind you, and they will make you miserable, because the things in this world can't provide true contentment. They can't provide fulfillment. They can't make you happy. Open your eyes and see those who are pursuing those things. And look at how their life is interrupted. Look at how they're miserable. Look at how they're searching from happiness in the next raise, or the next relationship, or the next marriage, or whatever it is. They're just not going to find fulfillment in those things. But unlike Jesus, Jesus will set you free. Mammon will enslave you. Jesus will set you free. If you're not serving Him tonight, give consideration to the parable of the unjust steward. Or if you're here and you've been serving Him, but you've been trying to serve Him a little bit, and you've been trying to serve yourself a little bit, draw the conclusion from this lesson that you can't do that. That you've got to decide. You've got to pick one. Secure for yourself not that physical provision, that physical comfortable future, but secure for yourself a home with God through obedience, by faith, by service, by giving to others. Because when this life is over, we're going to be judged based on how we handled what was God's. We're going to give an answer for that. Are you ready to give an answer? Are you living in such a way where you're ready to stand before God and say, I'm ready to show you how I've used what you've given me? And if you're not, I pray that you take consideration of this parable, that you make those changes that are necessary, that you be generous, that you be kind. You dedicate yourself to God and to His service, not to the things of this world. If anyone needs to respond to the invitation at this time, please do so as we stand and as we sing the song of encouragement.